ingredients like cocoa, the way they're produced matters a lot. So the book helps people learn how to identify more sustainably produced options.
So they can make smart decisions, informed decisions about the food we eat.
She hopes the book helps people better understand the impact their food choices have on the climate and inspires them to make wonderful meals that are better for the planet.
It's a delicious way to really make a difference.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Hello, welcome to Earth Riot Radio. I'm Savitri D. Reverend Billy is on a long train ride in the Deep South, taking a much-needed break, so I'm standing in today for this special edition of Earth Riot Radio, the fire edition. Like many of you, I've been watching the fires in Los Angeles, trying to respond. It's been a hard week for us, a lot of family in Los Angeles. My mother is from there, and my aunt and uncle had a ranch, the Zorthian Ranch, which burned to the ground in Altadena. Altadena is a special place in Los Angeles, a place of great diversity and integration, a place where African Americans built incredible creative lives and communities of artists living there, eccentric people, a little bit off the mainstream. Our hearts are with you, California, once again, in the thick of it. Today we'll talk with fire ecologist Rick Anderson, Sundar Ganglani, our resident composer of the Stop Shopping Choir, who's been living in Los Angeles and riding out these fires. And we'll just learn a little bit more about fire, hoping always to get closer to fire, get closer to the earth. In these moments when we are afraid and driven to build more walls and harden our security and shore it up, these are the times maybe to let the earth in a little closer. Enjoy the show.
Hallelujah.
I'd like to spend a little time now talking to Sundar Ganglani, a resident composer of the Stop Shopping Choir who's been living in Los Angeles and has been riding out these fires at his home in South Pasadena. He'll share some details, some observations, just an intimate view of a few days in the middle of a catastrophe.
Welcome to Earth Riot Radio, Sundar. I know you've been going through a lot out there in Los Angeles. And to our listeners, you'll know Sundar from many songs, as he is the longtime composer and singer in the Stop Shopping Choir. And he's living now in South Pasadena and has been out there all this week through these incredible fires. Sundar, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Me and my roommates are fine. It's been surreal and schizophrenic and strange, and it's interesting because we were both in New York for 9/11, we were in New York for COVID, and there's something about how the immediacy of 9/11, how the kind of almost like the moment of it just happened, and then it was the fall, we were in the consequence of it so quickly, and this is just in medias res, it just keeps going, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody wakes up and checks that app, mm-hmm. and like looks at the acreage, mm-hmm. you know, and imagines from wherever their vantage point is, imagines the patch of land that is either that has gotten bigger. It hasn't gotten smaller.
So I wonder if maybe you could share with us just in the last few days as you walk around, you know, just some of the sensations you've had, because we have this very limited view into that through social media or through the commercial media.
I think what's very present here is this idea of losing everything. Everybody either knows somebody, is somebody, or is one degree away from somebody who lost everything. You hear those words over and over again. You know, so-and-so lost everything, or, you know, this person lost everything, or I know somebody who, or, you know. And so in this way, whether or not it's conscious or unconscious, everybody is moving through the world with this understanding or measuring their life up against what that might mean, what that might be. This idea of losing everything, what is everything? And then everybody also is packing their go bags. We were evacuated, then not evacuated. And then there was a blip, an accident in the technology that sent out evacuation orders throughout East Los Angeles that set off some chaos and then took it back. And so everybody has these has been instructed to have these go bags, right?
What's in your go bag, Sundar?
My contact lenses and toiletries and my musical instruments. Having to make these decisions is an interesting door to pass through. Mm-hmm. To realize, I think, which is almost unilaterally, I think everybody is realizing that the things that have value to you don't necessarily have value beyond you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's a fascinating little family of objects that mean very little to other people.
And when you go outside now, are there ever any times where you don't smell fire, where the sky is blue? What is it like outside?
Yesterday and today were eerily, you wouldn't be able to know from waking up in the morning. The sunlight was shining for very proudly yesterday in our neighborhood. And today out the window right now, it is too. But if you go out, you can smell it, you know. I was standing in the parking lot and there was ash coming down from the sky, and I picked up a piece of paper, a blackened ash section of the Bible that had fallen from the sky. Scripture from 1 Chronicles 15:16, the procedure by which David was instructed to move the Ark of the Covenant is what landed in my hand, burnt. Yeah, and then the first few days, at least in our neighborhood, when the smoke with the winds, and the smoke, it felt as though the embodied experience was though that the day was beginning over and over again,
mm-hmm.
because this thick atmosphere of smoke would kind of eclipse the sun or hide it, and then it would reveal different from clouds, you know, very different from clouds, totally different. And really, it felt like you were uncertain about what time of day it was. You know, over and over again, over and over again, you were.
And are people working in Los Angeles, who aren't in affected areas? Is life just normal in some places?
Yes. Normal. Yes. You know, yesterday I went to Gold's Gym in Glendale and it was packed. People are staying home if they can or doing what they can at home.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as we know, as we learn from COVID, the service industry, people who serve things, people who are in cash registers, people who deliver things are always,
right.
always working.
Right.
And so I went to Gold's Gym and it was packed. It was packed. Packed. And there was a moment when everybody's emergency alert system at the same time.
And there at the
it was surreal, you know.
And I know you're part of different communities in Los Angeles and also relatively new to Los Angeles. So you have this interesting sort of outside view as you're experiencing this really spectacular event. And I just wonder, inside your communities, your various communities, are there any reactions or things happening that you feel you should share with us?
I woke up and I went to an AA meeting. Which is one of the sober community is a community I'm a part of. And I was in this meeting and all of a sudden it was sometimes the only things I have to compare it to are works of art, but it felt like a great Irish play. And I don't mean to really mean that. I mean to hold it, to say how profound it was, a great Irish. And these two gentlemen came in, walked into the room late to the meeting with a layer of soot, which reminded me of 9/11, that layer at lake that was just on the body, and sat down. There was silence and they shared and talked about how they'd spent the night trying to save their house.
Yeah. And it's incredible that you lose your house and then you go to a meeting in the morning to save your life. right?
Save your life, to save your life, that like you've spent the last 18 hours or something fighting to save these plots of land or these things, you lost everything.
Los Angeles is a big city. It's a big place. It's heartening to think of all the circles of people sitting around talking right now in all the ways that they are and all the incredible mutual aid springing up around the city. There's lots of ways to help, so just get on any social media platform, you'll find one. I'd like to turn now to Rick Anderson, fire ecologist. He joins us from Trinidad, where he's teaching fire ecology, teaching fire practices to people on the ground there and reintroducing some old ways in the Caribbean.
I'm here with Rick Anderson, forest ecologist. He joins us from Trinidad today, where he's doing some training. Welcome to Earth Riot Radio, Rick.
I'm happy to be here, Savvy.
When you look at a place like, you know, Southern California or, you know, these semi-urban landscapes, how does one mitigate these things in places like that at this point? Is it too late, really, to remediate or to get back into that conversation with fire?
Well, here's where it gets a little, first off, let's think about the Chicago fires of the early part of the 20th century. There were no regulations in terms of, and also in your own city of New York, I think there was some kind of textile mill that caught fire and burned a bunch of women. The short answer is, this is an urban situation. California needs to get their, we all need to get their act together on code to build fire-resistant buildings. Like the Getty building out there in California, it survived fire because they went the extra mile for mitigation. Once fire starts getting into your old hometown, Palisades, any of these, it's no longer a forest fire, but it behaves like a forest fire. It's burning from house to house to house. It's the propagation of the fire is in homes. So in the media right now, it's a forest fire or a wildfire, brush fire that caused all this. But it would have been a very different outcome had coding. You know, if you got a eucalyptus tree next to your house, one of the most flammable species on the planet, what do you think is going to happen? And it's also the propagation of embers from house to house, not a full-on flaming front. That's why some of those houses survive and some of them don't. So, of course, this is what we call a celebrity fire. It has a presence. This has happened many times before in more humble villages. Trailer parks have gone up to flames, but it's never going to get the attention that Malibu will, you know, or Beverly Hills. So that said, you know, part of the solution is the urban landscape. Think about it as an ecosystem of itself, and you don't want it to burn. So code yourself into construction techniques like some of the places in my home state of Florida has had to do with hurricanes.
I wanted to just talk to you what your thoughts are about like the demonizing of nature, you know, and how you deal with that, because you are a fire ecologist and I don't know anyone who's thought about fire more than you.
Fire was our friend for a very long time. You know, that old pioneer Florida cracker culture I come from, we're fire users. That's how I learned. We were Celtic people from, you know, the indentured servants they brought over from the heaths and heathers and moors of Scotland and Ireland and we had a practice of burning and sheep herding and hunting elk and deer in that part of the world. And when we got to the United States, we were right next to the indigenous people in the Southeast Coastal Plain who did the same thing. We were, you know, it was the poor man's plow. So for many, many generations of Homo sapiens, fire was our friend.
You're in Trinidad right now teaching fire ecology. And you were talking about this view of the forest as, what is the word you use, pristine?
Well, I call it the pristine myth. There's very few forests that actually are pristine. Humans have inhabited most forests for a very long time. If you think about the Maya civilization, just think how much firewood they would have needed for cooking. Just that simple little variable. You wouldn't have had jungles surrounding your human population. It would have been managed. It had been heavily managed. But yeah, one of the things we're trying to recover the fire knowledge in a lot of these areas has been overlaid by colonial forestry and modern NGOs that have hold them away, in the same idea of our national parks, to protect them, these precious areas. And so we're going against a really deep management mess and government perceptions and that kind of thing. And the other part of it is smoke. Tourists don't like smoke. And what I see in the pristine myth is a redemption motif. When we created our national parks around the, again, the manifest destiny had plowed right across all the way to the West Coast. We were well on the way to really realizing how much damage we had done. The Dust Bowl was not far away. The ecological indicators of having Europeans eat their way across the prairies and the mountains and to the coastline. Part of this, and this is a subtext I see in the Wilderness Act and everything else, we want to be able to say we have this great country, this incredible giving landscape, and we didn't destroy all of it. We saved some of it. We're good, kind, and benevolent people. Well, of course, at the same time we were creating these national parks, we were moving the indigenous people off. And even my own family was moved out of the Everglades to create a wilderness where a wilderness never existed. We've really lost contact. And then we built these kind of cathedrals, if you will, called national parks and wilderness areas. You know, part of the Wilderness Act, as kind of cool as it is that whole word untrammeled, no hand of man kind of thing, even though some of these places had serious populations of humans living in them before we got the ideation of creating, drawing a green line around it and legislating them out of the landscape and also their indigenous practices. Part of the emphasis on American conservation, one way or another, and this may be, again, a Leopold thing or maybe a Muir thing, is that they wanted a reasonable vignette of primitive America. It just didn't include indigenous practices. And that's probably was our big mistake in every imaginably, you know, both in terms of where we are now with indigenous populations and how we essentially burned the library when we hauled them off their land and putting them in school. I've got some colleagues like Frank Lake, who is he works for the Forest Service, but he's the liaison, and he's done a lot of good ecological research about the benefits of native burning, all the way to putting smoke on the Klamath River to where the insects start feeding on the nutrients, and the salmon eat the insects floating on the top of that. They burn at a time of year where the smoke gets deposited on the Klamath, and then they have a fish party after that.
The theft of fire for the benefit of humanity is a theme that recurs in many world mythologies, symbolizing the acquisition of knowledge or technology and its transformative impact on civilization. Its recurrent themes include trickster figures as the thief and supernatural heroic guardians who hoard fire from humanity, often out of mistrust for humans. In African mythology, the San people tell of Ikagan stealing fire from the ostrich and bringing it to people. In Cherokee myth, after Possum and Buzzard had failed to steal fire, Grandmother Spider used her web to sneak into the land of light. She stole fire, hiding it in a clay pot or a silk nest. In Greek mythology, the Titan god Prometheus steals the heavenly fire for humanity, enabling the progress of civilization, for which he was punished by being chained to a mountain and having his liver eaten by an eagle every day until being freed by the hero Heracles. In Polynesian myth, Maui is the thief of fire. An ancestress of Maui is the keeper of fire, and she stores it in her fingernails and toenails. Maui tricks her into giving him almost all of her nails, but she catches onto him and throws her last toenail down, engulfing the ground in flame and nearly killing Maui forever. Hello, welcome to News from the Natural World. I'm Savitri D. Fire is the rapid oxidation of a material, the fuel, in the exothermic chemical process of combustion, releasing heat, light, and various reaction products. At a certain point in the combustion reaction, called the ignition point, flames are produced. The flame is the visible portion of the fire. Flames consist primarily of carbon dioxide, water vapor, oxygen, and nitrogen. If hot enough, the gases may become ionized to produce plasma. Fire is a significant process that influences ecological systems worldwide. The positive effects of fire include stimulating growth and maintaining various ecological systems. Its negative effects include hazard to life and property, atmospheric pollution, and water contamination. When fire removes protective vegetation, heavy rainfall can contribute to increased soil erosion by water. Additionally, the burning of vegetation releases nitrogen into the atmosphere. Fire is one of the four classical elements and has been used by humans in rituals, in agriculture, for clearing land, for cooking, generating heat and light, for signaling, propulsion purposes, smelting, forging, incineration of waste, cremation, and as a weapon or mode of destruction. Wildfire is first recorded in the late Silurian fossil record, 420 million years ago, by fossils of charcoalified plants. Apart from a controversial gap in the late Devonian, charcoal is present ever since. The level of atmospheric oxygen is closely related to the prevalence of charcoal. Fire also became more abundant when grasses radiated and became the dominant component of many ecosystems around 6 to 7 million years ago. This kindling provided tinder, which allowed for the more rapid spread of fire. As far as we know, Earth is the only planet where fire is possible, as it is dependent on an abundance of oxygen. Claims for the earliest definitive evidence of control of fire by a member of Homo range from 1.7 to 2 million years ago. Evidence for the microscopic traces of wood ash as controlled use of fire by Homo erectus begins roughly 1 million years ago. Some of the earliest known traces of controlled fire were found at the Daughters of Jacob Bridge in Israel and dated to 790,000 years ago. And some studies suggest cooking started 1.8 million years ago. The use and control of fire was a gradual process. The first stage was a change in habitat from dense forest where wildfires were rare but difficult to escape, to savanna, where wildfires were common but easier to survive. Such a change may have occurred about 3 million years ago, when the savanna expanded in East Africa due to cooler and drier climate. The next stage involved interaction with burned landscapes and foraging in the wake of wildfires, as observed in various wild animals today. An early step in the control of fire would have been transporting it from burned to unburned areas and lighting them on fire with it, providing advantages in food acquisition. The ability to make fire, generally with a friction device with hardwood rubbing against softwood, as in a bow drill, was a later development. The control of fire enabled important changes in human behavior, health, energy expenditure, and geographic expansion. After the loss of body hair, hominids could move into much colder regions that would have previously been uninhabitable. It also allowed humans to develop tool and weapon making, art and ceramics, social development, and nighttime activities. Here are some things we know about fire. Fire can double every 30 seconds. Given the right conditions, it takes just half a minute for a fire to double in size. A house can be completely engulfed in flames in just 2.5 minutes. Fire changes color based on oxygen levels. Varying degrees of oxygen can change the color of a flame. A blue flame means lots of oxygen, while a yellow flame means low oxygen supply. Fire may have ended the bubonic plague. As devastating as it was, the Great Fire of London in 1666 is believed to have been what ultimately put an end to the uncontrollable spread of the bubonic plague. It's estimated that 80% of the city was destroyed in the fiery blaze, and a large number of the city's rats and fleas died in the process. This significantly slowed down the spread of the disease. Fire can make trees explode. If there's enough water deep within a tree, the steam produced by the burning fire can cause the tree to explode. You can make water with fire. The chemical reaction of fire burning produces a tiny bit of water. If you put a cold spoon or an empty metal pot over a naked flame, you'll see drops of condensed water appear inside. You can also start a fire using water. Pure water isn't flammable, but one of its main components, hydrogen, is. Using energy such as an electrical current to break up the chemical elements that water is made of can create a spark and consequently start a fire. Oxygen makes fire hotter. The more oxygen there is, the hotter the flames are. Fires are affected by gravity. Combustion gases rise, so as a flame moves upwards, it sucks in more oxygen, making it burn faster and stronger. This is why wildfires spread more quickly uphill than downhill. Wildfire can travel at a rate of up to 6.7 miles per hour in forests and up to 14.27 miles per hour in grasslands. In 2017, the Thomas Fire in California spread so quickly that it moved at a rate equivalent to a football field per second. How hot is a fire? A candle flame typically burns at around 1,000 degrees Celsius. More than 80% of U.S. wildfires are caused by humans. Once a fire starts, warmer temperatures and drier conditions can help fires spread and make them harder to put out. Warmer, drier conditions also contribute to the spread of the mountain pine beetle and other insects that weaken or kill trees, building up the fuels in a forest. Global carbon emissions from forest fires have increased 60% since 2001. In 2022, wildfires in the boreal forests of Canada produced more carbon emissions than the burning of fossil fuels in all but the three largest polluters, China, India, and the United States. Last week in Los Angeles, unprecedented wildfires rapidly burned almost 60 square miles, an area larger than San Francisco. 19 people are dead, and over 10,000 structures, including homes, schools, churches, and businesses, have burned to the ground. Countless animals have been lost. Although a once-in-a-decade Santa Ana windstorm is fanning the extreme fires, accelerating hydroclimate whiplash is the key climate connection. After years of severe drought, dozens of atmospheric rivers deluged California with record-breaking precipitation in the winter of 2023, burying mountain towns in snow, flooding valleys with rain and snowmelt, and setting off hundreds of landslides. Southern California was underwater less than a year ago. Torrential rain from atmospheric rivers started in December and reached a crescendo in early February when nearly a foot fell in Los Angeles, resulting in abundant grass and brush. 2024 brought a record hot summer and now a record dry start to the 2025 rainy season, along with the tinder dry vegetation that is burning now. It hasn't rained in Los Angeles since May. For the moment, these fires are among the most destructive in the history of the state of California. And as of this recording, they are less than 10% contained. Volatile Santa Ana winds are expected to return this week. Hey, all right. Thanks for listening to Earth Riot Radio. I'm Savitri D. Big shout out to Reverend Billy on that train ride to New Orleans. And I'd like to thank our producer, Jason Candler, our guests, Rick Anderson and Sundar Ganglani. Stay safe out there, Sundar. And of course, the wonderful singing of the Stop Shopping Choir. I know these are tough days. We got a new president coming in, an old one going out, and it just keeps piling up. And the earth is talking to us. The earth is speaking, as ever. So if you're listening, I think it's a good time to get your little crew together and get ready for what's coming in the next couple of years. If you're not an activist now, you might want to get an affinity group together. That's a group of people you trust, people you can talk to, people you can be courageous with, take risks with. They don't have to be your friends. They don't have to be your coworkers or your family members. These are people you share values with and trust. Because it's a good time to get ready. Change and be changed. And if you're out there in Los Angeles, take care of yourselves, take care of your neighbors. Good luck. We're thinking about you. We'll send you what we have, what we can. I know these are hard days. Earthaluya.